From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening. We're going to start with breaking news. On the line with me is Jackie Hollander. You know Jackie as a regular guest on the program here, and she has some news regarding the James Brown Trust. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Dana. How are you tonight?
I'm doing just fine. We've got breaking news. You've been a very busy lady. What's going on?
Yeah, we do have some breaking news here. We filed in a federal court in Chicago yesterday, about 5 minutes of five. And, of course, I think it was about 5 minutes of five when South Carolina received the email that was taken from the clerk of the court to the judge residing over the case down there over the I Feel Good Children's Trust.
Now, just refresh my listeners' memories what the trust is all about, and whose trust is it?
Well, James Brown and I created this trust in 1987. There are, and no one is really clear on the exact figure, but I can tell you it is in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. If you, excuse me, if you look at it in the long run, it could be in the billions.
Wow.
Basically, because we were partners in a partnership in this trust, when he died, I am the survivor. So it would go to me.
Wow. Now, this motion was filed last minute. What does that mean for someone that doesn't quite understand what's going to happen now?
What is going to happen is we have argued that down in South Carolina, they obviously did not want me in the courtrooms down there.
Right.
They did not want the evidence in the court. They did not want the truth in the court. 100% of this money, when Mr. Brown and I were, prior to the rape, working together, we were both putting our money in towards this trust.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is to see to it that this money goes to the poor, to the needy, to the children who, you know, have problems. And that's, of course, rape victims, and that's my goal here.
Now, obviously, this is going to, once your motion is filed, this is going to go back to court. Have they given you a timeline?
No, it was actually posted this afternoon in Chicago, and I know that the AP has already picked it up, and they were talking to us. So, I mean, it's kind of been a very quick breaking thing where, you know, it's kind of caught, it slapped everybody by surprise, and that was my intention. I knew that I had to drive back from South Carolina. I knew the judge was going to possibly render a decision that would cripple the trust and see to it that 50% of the money would be going to people that were not involved in the trust, nor were they poor or needy. It was Mr. Brown's children who were suing, and his former wife who were suing to receive money, and they were trying to settle out of the trust that belonged to the poor and needy. And so I knew I was on a time limit. I knew I had to sneak back in. I was not aware of whether or not I could actually pull this off. But, of course, I used my lawyer that has been with me for over 7 or 8 years. It took me all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So I knew, and he knew what we had. And in a twist of fate, someone that I had been up against for 23 years, Buddy Dallas, who was James Brown's lawyer. Excuse me, my cell phone is going off. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
He actually gave an affidavit to it all and told the truth, a 3-page affidavit. And that cleared the way
and
going to federal court.
And without getting into too much detail, Buddy Dallas said...
Buddy Dallas said that indeed I and James Brown did create this trust. Actually, it's not in front of me. I was going to read to you a few of them, but that we did create it, and that I am the sole survivor of this trust.
Wow. Well, indeed, this is breaking news.
Yes, because I am the rape victim and of this man, and to get an affidavit notarized by the lawyer that I went up against for 23 long years, mortal enemies who finally turned around and said, here's the truth. And it was incredible to see that, and it really touched my heart, and you know, hopefully now it's cleared the way for the federal court of the state of Illinois to, we are going to intervene and try to bring the trust up here. We can see to it that the money is dispersed to the poor and to the needy.
All right. Well, Jackie, thank you for coming on with very short notice, and we'll be in touch and follow the story very closely.
Dana Pritzer, thank you for all the support, all the prayers you have given me, because I would probably have given up a long time ago without the Dana Pritzer Show, without Scared Monkeys behind me, and without the beautiful people that have given their prayers that go on your show and blog. And if you would ask them to please start blogging for the rights of the poor, the needy, the rape victims, and those that are oppressed, and help me win this in the federal courts.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So that's indeed breaking news when it comes to the James Brown Trust, and you'll know Jackie Hollander is a regular guest here, and it should be interesting. There's a lot of money at stake and a lot of needy people who could use that money. This is Dana Pritzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Talk about breaking news. We have some news in the Becca McAvoy case, and it's news that I'm sure nobody really wanted to hear. My next guest, Wendy Murphy, you'll know as a former DA and author, law professor, media commentator, you name it, and one of the most popular guests on the program. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Dana. Good to be with you.
You know, this family has gone through everything, up to 8 delays. Now, all of a sudden, we're hearing, and I think you're hearing the same as I am, from my source as a news reporter from down there, that the DA that was handling the case has got himself in a little bit of trouble. What have you heard?
Yeah. That's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
Boy, you know, you can't make this stuff up, Dana, can you?
No.
Apparently the DA handling the case is now a resigned DA, no longer even working in the office. Reports are, and we haven't confirmed this, I haven't confirmed this personally, but reports are that there's some reason to believe he's been investigated by FBI officials in connection with his own inappropriate sexual activity online, and that he declined to answer specific questions about whatever they discovered when they executed a warrant at his house, and as a result, he resigned. You know, apparently, the strange thing as well is that he was involved in the prosecution of a judge in the same building, and the judge was being prosecuted for sexually inappropriate activity with prisoners and others. You know, if you say this stuff out loud and you're not you know, an official news source, people think you're crazy, they think you're a conspiracy theorist, you're making stuff up, you're imagining things.
Right.
But this is, apparently is all coming from real sources.
Yep.
And most folks I know down there are saying, this shouldn't surprise people, this was always a cesspool of bad behavior. And I don't want to say it's all been reported as sexually inappropriate stuff, but boy, you know, this poor family, all they ever wanted was a day in court, and horrible thing after horrible thing has happened, and now this. I think that this won't likely undermine their case. It might put the brakes on a little bit, and that's also terrible since they've been waiting so long, but you know, just because a prosecutor has stepped down, or, you know, I was a prosecutor. Sometimes we had to give birth, and I had five kids, so you have to take time off for whatever happens in life. That doesn't mean the case dissolves. By, you know, to some extent, prosecutors are fungible, and that's the good news for Becca's family. It's just... It's almost Shakespearean what this family has gone through waiting for justice for that child.
You know, and the source that came to me said that this judge is accused of trading sexual favors for leniency. He was alleged to have had inmates from the county jail forcing them to perform sex acts and or paddling them. And it makes you wonder, Wendy, your book, Injustice for Some. We see the DAs, we see the judges, and I know it's a minuscule proportion of what there is across North America, but we're hearing about it, and it makes you wonder, is there anyone that we can trust when it comes to these sorts of cases?
Yeah, you know, good question. Although I always say, look, just because there's been one high-profile case doesn't mean everybody's bad.
Right.
On the other hand, if there's one thing we know about sexual stuff and sexual violence and sexual exploitation, it's that it's a power crime. And, you know, it's not news. That's people who know this crime have said this for a long, long time, that the bad guys, and sometimes it's women, but the bad guys, generally speaking, are abusing a position of power. So it shouldn't shock us to hear that it's a judge or a lawyer. You know, they have power in society, and taking advantage of the powerless is part of that epidemic. You know, generally speaking, people who are sitting in positions of authority like judges and prosecutors are good people trying to do a good thing for society. And in all my years, I have to say, although it may be that I just didn't know, I've never seen a judge get in trouble for sexual abuse or sexual exploitation. I've heard of, and in fact, I know of certain people who got in trouble for bribery. That's a much bigger problem, I think, than sexual exploitation. People taking payoffs and the like, and I saw that firsthand. But, you know, by and large, I think it's important to be able to trust the people in charge. But it's also important to have the capacity to be a skeptical consumer of information and to be skeptics about the integrity of the process. If you believe that there's corruption, and if you have reason to suspect that things have gone afoul, don't think you're crazy. This is my message to the people with whom I work all the time, and I mostly represent people who've been victimized, so it's a bit of a bias, but you know, I say to them, just because you think what you're hearing is crazy doesn't mean you are crazy. And it's important to raise a fuss, to talk to others. You know, unfortunately, if one person says, I think a judge is on the take, or I think a judge is getting sexual favors in exchange for leniency, if you say that alone, people might say you're crazy, but there's a good chance if it's true and you say it out loud, other people will say, hey, that happened to me too. And that's one of the reasons it's so important to speak out and not to be afraid, even you know, not being afraid of people thinking you're crazy, because if it's real, it's real, and you got to talk about it. And you know, that's one of the things I try to teach people, is that you're speaking truth to power. That means you're going to get slammed down, but be brave about it.
Wendy Murphy is here. What drew my attention and wanted me to bring you on the program tonight, Wendy, is your last couple of op-eds, and I think they're so important to talk about tonight and so current when it comes to some of the cases that we're reading about and hearing about, in particular the Anthony case. And you look at the sedative aspect of it. There's the pornography aspect in one of your op-eds, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but there's this whole sedatives and drugging children, for lack of a better term. Let's talk about these two op-eds. Let's talk about the first one.
Yeah, you know, the topic is so big that it does a disservice to try to put it in a 700-word op-ed. But,
right.
You know, that my boss tells me that's my limit, so I have to cut a lot. And I get, you know, and I get good and important critical feedback sometimes for not saying more. But let me boil it down and try to expand a little bit with the benefits of radio time and internet radio time in particular. Can talk a little bit more in depth. I think it's incredibly important and sort of surprising to me that it's not more well understood to talk about the role of sedatives in the business of child pornography, because ask anybody who knows anything about this. If you know a little bit or you know a lot, you know that one of the key components of getting kids to comply with either pimping for sex or pimping for porn or both, and they're often connected, is that you have to sort of physiologically get kids to be obedient. And that means, you know, you can't say to a child, oh, just lay down and be quiet. You literally have to sedate them, mm-hmm. not to the point where they're unconscious, because child pornographers don't like that. They don't want the child to be completely out of it. They want the child to be obedient and compliant and passive, but alert enough that they look to be awake. So you got to give a sedative that will make them complacent. And then the benefit of certain sedatives, such as benzodiazepines, and I mean Klonopin and Ativan and the cheap alternative of chloroform, they not only make kids compliant without knocking them out cold, they provide what's called an amnestic feature, which is to say when the child wakes up from the haze of the drug, the haze of the sedative, they don't remember what happened. And for obvious reasons, that's beneficial to the industry. They don't want kids to tell. And a kid who doesn't understand or remember because they were in a fog is a perfect non-witness, so to speak, for the event. So it's been, you know, it's been known for a long time that sedatives are part of the industry. Mental health professionals who treat traumatized children who have some sense that something bad happened, but they don't remember the details, but their bodies certainly remember being abused. When they grow up and they start to remember bits and pieces, and they suffer with PTSD and other symptomatology associated with sexual trauma, they will describe being drugged and feeling woozy around their offenders. And very often, Dana, it's the parents. And let's be very clear about this. The former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez read to Congress some statistics that shouldn't shock people. The most common makers of child porn are parents, because they have access, intimate access, behind closed doors. And, you know, obviously that's a lot easier to get away with than if you're a stranger trying to clip a child. But once you understand the role of sedatives, then you can certainly appreciate why it's so hard to uncover the crime, because the victims can't speak. But again, when they get older, and again, talking about mental health professionals with whom I work who deal with traumatized kids and adults, what they tell me is that basically in their practice, 100% of the victims of child pornography and so-called parent pimping or, you know, caretaker pimping that we see and hear about, 100% of those kids are sedated in some fashion. So it shouldn't surprise us to hear somebody like me say, let's talk about the relationship between sedatives and child porn. But the reason my op-ed got a lot of attention is because I connected the dots between sedatives and three high-profile cases that may or may not be about child porn, and I say that in my piece. I don't know
right.
the details. I haven't had access to the entire files, although I'd like to,
right.
and why the files in these cases are being withheld from public view, I think should have us scratching our heads. But JonBenet Ramsey, Kaylee Anthony, and Madeline McCann are all cases where there is talk of sedatives and or talk of child pornography. And so, you know, let's use a little bit of common sense and ask tough questions. It doesn't mean there is a connection. It doesn't mean I'm right. But it certainly should be part of the conversation if it's true statistically that the vast majority of child pornography involves the use of sedatives. Then it seems to me every single case involving a child who goes missing or shows up dead and there's some kind of implication of sexual misconduct and you have talk of sedatives, it seems to me part of the conversation should involve pornography and, you know, what might be the motive. And very often, Dana, and I say this in my piece, it isn't that somebody wanted these children to die. It's that children can die by accident.
Right.
When sedatives are introduced into a child's body, unlike adults who can absorb high amounts of sedatives, you know, things like Klonopin and Ativan, for children, two things happen that don't really happen to the same degree as they do. That things happen to children that don't happen to adults. They have quickly and severely reduced respiratory rates, and that can lead to you know, failure of the respiratory system and thus accidental death, or they can have seizures related with a high dose and long-term use of sedatives, especially with regard to short-term withdrawal. And so if a child ends up dead while you're trying to do something inappropriate with them, then, of course, there needs to be the cover-up and all that that entails, and that may have something to do with some of the mysteries in these cases. I don't know, but I think it's part of the story we have to talk about. And until law enforcement comes out in any of these cases and says, hey, this has nothing to do with child porn, it has nothing to do with sexual exploitation or sexual abuse, there's no role for sedatives here in terms of the way these children died, until law enforcement says we're wrong, it should be part of the discussion.
Absolutely. Connect the dots and you'd be surprised where they point. I've got about 2 minutes left, Wendy, and I want to talk a little bit about UC Davis. And they're showing a porno and calling it free speech. How crazy is that?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, this is the op-ed that I'm publishing this week at patriotledger.com, and all of my columns can be found there, is all about how absurd it is. Because what UC Davis did, now look, people can watch pornography in this country, and it is protected speech. I wish that it weren't, but it is.
Right.
But college campuses are different. They are considered special places under the law, and no college campus has a right to show stuff that ultimately subjugates and increases the risk of sexual violence, but subjugates women and literally creates an increased risk of sexual violence, and then call itself a responsible academic community. What's interesting is at UC Davis, they allowed it to be shown as entertainment. And here's the rub. If you were showing porn in an academic classroom where you wanted to teach students about the harm of porn, you can do that. I showed a film called The Price of Pleasure in my class 2 weeks ago. My students were watching it because it is a condemnation and an expose of the harm of the porn industry and the way that women's bodies are brutalized and mutilated and destroyed. I mean, women in the quote-unquote industry, this is not, you know, Splendor in the Grass stuff. We're talking about women's bodies being ripped apart.
Yeah.
So much so that 6 weeks after they joined the business, they can't even work anymore. They have no value in the industry. This is brutal, violent, vicious stuff. This is not a little erotic romp in the hay. And so for a school like UC Davis to want to show this stuff as entertainment, not as education, but entertainment, really raises profound questions about what they feel about women's role in society. Are they trying to subjugate women? Do they want rape on campus? Do they think men should be inspired to do these things to women? I mean, where are they coming from? To call this free speech, I think, is the ultimate insult, because even if in the real world free speech is protected, even if it means degrading, disgusting, violent pornography, schools should be better than the real world. Schools hold a position of great honor and leadership in this country. They should rise above the crap we tolerate in the real world, because they are training our next leaders, and they're training the people who will then be teaching our children about what the policy position should be when it comes to politics, the economy, law, the arts, respect for human beings, and in particular women. Are you kidding me that that's the training ground they want to breed? God help us all if that's the kind of hate they want to promote and the ideas they want to promote at the university. And one of the points I make is, how dare they suggest this is free speech when it comes to violent, hate-filled, visual, quote-unquote, speech toward women? Would they ever, I asked them this question, would they ever tolerate films that celebrate the sexual violence and subjugation of other types of people, Jews, blacks, Muslims? Would they ever show those films Friday night for student entertainment and call it, as UC Davis did, a safe alternative to boozing? Are you kidding me? They would never, ever tolerate movies that celebrate the subjugation and the violent abuse of any other type of person in society. Why they do it toward women raises profound questions about why any one of us should spend a dime sending our children there to be educated.
Absolutely. Well said. Thank you, Wendy.
Thanks, Dana. Talk again soon.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. You can get her book, And Justice for Some. Just follow the link on the show notes. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. I have Ed Losey on the line with me. You'll know Ed as a PR guy out of Los Angeles and a close follower of the Phil Spector trial. In fact, the victim in this case, Lana Clarkson, was one of his clients. Hi, Ed. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Dana. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. What's going on? We've heard that a juror was sick. We've heard that the jury is still out. We've heard that they're asking more questions. This delay is starting to drive me crazy.
Well, yeah, there were delays. They were off last week. So they really have only had about 3 days of actual deliberations going on, four. So, you know, we would like to have it over in 10 minutes, but the fact that it's now 4 days, I think we have another dumbed down jury. But, you know, I'm hoping that he is convicted of the first, the major charge, you know, which is manslaughter, which would be 18 years in prison, which would be great, so that he's in for life, because he is a gun crazy psycho, and he's going to do it again. That's what they do. You know, they're not curable. So he's a menace to society. So we're kind of worried, and a lot of people are worried, that he had threatened to kill and to maim and to ruin their careers, which he's done over 4 years. And some of that testimony was played in the courtroom, tapes that he left, which was used as evidence against him. So even with that, I can't believe the jury is arguing about this right behind closed doors right now.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. You know, Phil Spector is a loon. There's no doubt about that. And what we haven't heard much about, or we don't hear much about, is the kind of person Lana was. Let's hear about her a little bit.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because of Lana Clarkson's death, Phil Spector was resurrected, because at the time of her death, he was a has-been nobody. At one time, he was, you know, a big deal in rock and roll. But now he's become recycled again, and he's going to enjoy that part of it, bringing attention to his music capabilities and careers, which are, you know, which is a good thing for him. He wrote a lot of great music. But at the same time, you know, he's a sick guy. And this lovely person, Lana Clarkson, who's a very spiritual woman, who close to 1,000 people attend her memorial ceremony, and was very well known by every casting director and producer in this town as a hardworking SAG-AFTRA equity actress for 25 years. I know, because we both started our careers around the same time. Beautiful girl.
Absolutely gorgeous.
She was just awesome. She walked into a room, and that was the end. Everything just stopped. And just out of her 40s, she's murdered. You know, she was 40. Six years and 2 months ago.
Yeah.
He's been out, this guy, on $1 million bail. And negotiated by Bob Shapiro, a very capable lawyer, who Spector sued to get his retainer back, because he said he didn't do anything. We only got him out.
Jeez.
Walking around now, free, years. He can go anywhere in the country. He can't leave the country, except by permission. He's not wearing a collar. Okay. He's out in restaurants and he's out partying, and he's got a 20-something wife who is in there for whatever reason,
yeah,
whatever agenda she has. So I have no sympathy for him.
No.
There are those who do, and it's, which is baffling. There are those who actually think that Lana Clarkson went over to his place, a guy that she had never met before, to commit suicide.
And that's
their defense, even to this day.
That's the total bizarre part about this. It's totally bizarre, Ed. And my last question to you, and I appreciate your time this evening, and I know we're all waiting for the jury to bring back a verdict, but a lot of people will talk about Hollywood justice or Hollywood injustice, O.J., Robert Blake, now Spector. For someone that's been in the business as long as you have, you are in Hollywood, you know Hollywood. Is there such thing as justice served in something like this?
Well, the only justice is going to be what the verdict's going to be. The good thing, by the way, is that this year, this trial, Judge Fidler is allowing a lesser charge,
yeah,
for the jury to consider, which would mean a involuntary manslaughter, which would be a 2 to 4 year term in prison with a 1 year mandatory added to it for the use of a firearm in a crime. So he's facing 3 to 5, hopefully. He still may walk altogether.
Yeah.
And he also may go down. So there's 3 different options that are going to happen. He's going to walk, he's going to go in for 18 years, or he's going to go in for 3 to 5. We're hoping that he doesn't walk.
Well, 18 years for him is, like you say, a life sentence, and we're all...
So would be 5 years.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So he's not going to be able to deal with that. He's too fragile, and he's drug ridden, and you know, when they take him off the drugs, he's probably going to go within months, which we hope. But I don't feel like paying taxpayers' dollar. I don't feel like paying my taxpayers to keep that crazy guy alive. The Lana Clarkson thing, you know, she, the defense that they've been using is that. Her whole life was over because she was turning 40.
Oh, jeez.
So she had to be depressed because obviously she was turning 40. And she wrote emails to friends, you know, and they took things out of context like, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
But then when you read the whole paragraph, it's, if I have to sit and listen to this person one more time, I'm going to kill myself.
It's a figure of speech, and
yeah, exactly. And yeah, good lawyering will bring, you know, will do that. It's good lawyering, but Alan Jackson, the district attorney here in Los Angeles, is a brilliant. So he's, you know, he's up against Doran Weinberg, who is also a good attorney, San Francisco lawyer. They breed good lawyers up there, like my former client Melvin Belli, the great attorney.
Exactly. Well, it should be interesting to see what happens, Ed, and we're keeping our fingers crossed. Thanks. Thanks for coming on tonight.
There's Dan, there's good pictures of Lana, which you don't see, on our site, lozypr.com, and there's some good information too if your viewers want to look at that, some interviews that are up there concerning Lana Clarkson. So I appreciate you putting me on, and I hope everything turns out good for you.
Yeah.
Hope you've been well.
We'll talk soon, Ed.
Okay, Dana. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. And yeah, go to the link in the show notes. I sat down earlier today with Harvey Levin from TMZ to get an update on the Chris Brown and Rihanna apparent plea bargain. My sources are telling me that this plea bargain is going to go ahead, and Chris Brown will do no jail time and will plead to a misdemeanor. Will that happen? I don't know. I think TMZ has done a great job covering the story. It's not all just about some celebrity standing on the street corner picking their nose. TMZ does do good work, and kudos to them for bringing this story forward the way that they have. Here's my conversation with Harvey Levin. Okay, we're back. You know, following up on the Chris Brown and Rihanna case, I thought I'd go to one of the best sources of information. You know TMZ.com, and you know Harvey Levin as the managing editor of TMZ.com, and, of course, the television show TMZ. Harvey, welcome to the program.
Good talking to you, Dana.
You know, it's I got to give you kudos. You guys have done a kick-ass job, and I'm not being stupid by saying that term. When it comes to covering this story, you guys have brought forward the tragic problem of domestic violence in the United States, and in this case, a high-profile case of it. And I want to get your thoughts on that, and then we'll get into the apparent plea deal that's coming up.
Well, I mean, I just think this is an important case because, you know, it really does put a face on domestic violence and the fact that people who are, you know, in trouble are not always people who are, you know, poor without means, that this is something that comes in all shapes, sizes, and demographics and everything else. And, you know, people relate to Rihanna. People love her, they relate to her. A lot of people related to Chris Brown, and it is a stunning case, and it shows that it's not a vicious, mean, awful-looking person who could be an abuser. And I think that this case opened a lot of eyes.
Absolutely. And, you know, when people think of TMZ, they think of the, you know, the celebrity and the paparazzi and all that sort of stuff. But you guys went above and beyond covering this story and bringing about the epidemic, actually, of domestic violence across North America. Now, we're hearing, Harvey, and you guys are reporting it, about a possible plea deal. Not surprised. I've had Mark Garagos on the program. Of course, he's not talking about this right now, and the DA, actually, and I can see this happening, but I'm a consequences kind of guy. If you do the crime, you should do the time, and I'm curious what you think.
Well, I'm not sure he's going to do the time, but I think he's going to plead to the crime, or at least a crime. I am, what we reported 4 or 5 days ago when we found out was they're in intense negotiations and they're close to a plea deal. My guess is, and this is just a hunch, Chris Brown will accept some kind of jail time, but it's probably going to be minimal, 30 or 60 days, that's my guess. And in return, he'll plead either no contest or guilty to some form of battery or assault, and that will be it.
Well, there has to be something come forward out of this. Now, you've been a reporter, you're an attorney, you've been involved in the business for a long time. When I saw that picture of Rihanna, and in fact I was talking to Denise Brown about it, I think about Nicole Brown Simpson, and I look at the parallels between the two cases, or in particular the pictures of the two, and I don't know if you guys took any flack for posting that picture, but I think it was a great thing that you did there.
Well, you know, I'm not going to get into, you know, how we got the picture or anything else. We obtained it legally. I got to tell you, I mean, I've said it before. At the time we got it, we didn't think it was a police photo. The cops are certainly suggesting it is now.
Yeah.
But I do think it puts a face on all of this. And everybody had already said Rihanna was the alleged victim in the case, so that wasn't a surprise. It's just this, you know, when both sides are spinning, it was a minor, it was this, it was that. I mean, this kind of shows what it was.
Just one last question, and I really appreciate your time, Harvey. Again, TMZ, not only do you cover the celebrities, what they're doing, but you also cover the hard news stories in a different way of doing it. You're not mainstream media, but you're what I like to call main street media. You do it a little differently, and of course with the internet the way that it is right now with my blog and of course your website and others, Drudge, out there, we seem to bring a different picture to the people, and I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, look, I think that traditional media has lost its way.
Yeah.
I think they've really lost its way. They're doing the same stuff they did 35, 40 years ago. They haven't evolved. I mean, it's gotten boring. It's gotten predictable. And you know, I also think that they all just travel in packs, that, you know, one person says something and then everybody says something. And I think that, you know, that independent thinking is something that's kind of been lost in traditional media. And also point of view. It's like, there is, you know, every media outlet has some point of view. I mean, they may lie and say they don't, but they do.
Mm-hmm.
They come at it in a certain way. We're just very open about our point of view. So, you know, I think that you know, the staleness of traditional media kind of opened the door for us.
And you're doing a great job. Harvey, I appreciate it. I'd like to have you on again sometime. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely, Dan. It's good talking to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
That's Harvey Levin from TMZ. And, you know, you might see a picture of George Clooney scratching his behind on the street corner, and people laughing at it. That's fun. You know, people want to see that kind of stuff. But you're also seeing some of the hard news stories. And I think that, in fact, I know that they did a great job with the Rihanna and Chris Brown story. And it looks like they're going to be doing lots with Howard K. Stern, too. So just tune in to TMZ.com. And, of course, you can find TMZ on television pretty much everywhere. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
All right, we're back. It's always a pleasure to have my next guest on the program. Mike McIntyre is a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. He's also the host of Crime and Punishment, the radio show on the Chorus and Rolco Radio Network Sundays from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And his new book, Devil Among Us, How Canada Failed to Stop a Pedophile, is it out or is it coming out, Mike?
It is already out, actually. Came out a few months back, and actually we're already into printing number two.
You know what? I heard that, too, and my apologies and congratulations on that. I want to start, because I haven't had you on the program for a while. It seems like every time we turn around, we're losing police officers in North America, Oakland, Pittsburgh most recently. I think there was three lost. Oakland, there was four. Up here in Saskatchewan, not far from where you and I are, a couple of years back, we lost a couple of RCMP officers. And the Curtis Dagenais trial just ended here not that long ago, although it was apparently going to appeal. Your thoughts on the verdict?
Well, I can't say I was all that surprised. His defense essentially was one of self-defense, and I think when you talk about asking the public to buy into the fact that police here were in the wrong, which is essentially what he was accusing them of when they lost their lives, I think that was a difficult and certainly disturbing concept to many. At the end of the day, I wasn't surprised that the jury came back with a conviction. I guess he's now going to cite all kinds of potential errors in how the judge instructed the jury and some of the evidence that was heard. But, you know, I think when we talk about police officers under attack, society as a whole recognizes that these days police officers are under siege like never before. It seems like the respect for authority has been eroded so much. And as you say, Dana, just look at what happened this past weekend in Pittsburgh. A seemingly routine domestic call. I think it actually started with a call about a dog that was urinating on a carpet and a bit of a dispute over that. Police show up onto a very sleepy neighborhood street and are ambushed and killed. And we've seen this play out time and time again. Of course, everyone's familiar with what happened in Marathorpe, Alberta, where four RCMP officers were ambushed and killed, and in this case in Saskatchewan. So I think that clearly Curtis Dagenais, like so many others, had very little respect for authority and was not afraid to get violent on them, and ultimately it took the lives of two officers.
What we're seeing, although not on as big a scale, though, Mike, in Oakland, for example, protests, I guess, for the cop shooter. We're seeing a little bit, I guess, maybe with a small faction supporting Curtis Dagenais, but it seems like with police in general, there's that danger that we're never seeing like we had before. Like you say, Pittsburgh, you're going to a small domestic.
You know, I think as well the actions of police are perhaps coming under scrutiny like never before as well. It is a bit of a two-way street. Certainly in Winnipeg, where I work out of, just a week ago, Dana, we had two Winnipeg police officers arrested.
Yeah.
And one of them charged with attempted murder. This was for a shooting where it wasn't the police that got shot, but it was a citizen. And after a very lengthy investigation, we've now seen charges laid against two officers, and essentially the allegation is that this was a deliberate attempt to kill a civilian, I might add, who's a known a car thief and has a criminal record. But at the end of the day, these officers will now have to have their day in court. And it's been interesting watching the public reaction. It really is divided. There's one camp, I think, that that will, you know, back the police at any cost. And even in these circumstances where you've had an officer accused of shooting a man who was unarmed in the back and without really any reason to do so, a lot of the public says, you know, good, I wish we'd see more of this police, you know, acting out and sort of making a stand, because look what they have to go through. But there is certainly a segment of the population out there that is very suspicious of police these days. Of course, we all know about some of the incidents involving the use of tasers. And I think there's a segment of the population, I don't want to necessarily say it's a growing movement, but there is a movement that feels that the police are corrupt and that they bring a lot of the problems on themselves based on the way they treat people and some of the things they do. And, you know, like any profession, Dana, I guess there's always going to be a few bad apples in the bunch, and the same goes with police officers. It's unfortunate that a few bad apples can sort of spoil the bunch.
Mike McIntyre is here. You know, and I agree with you completely, Mike. And in the past, I have been critical of administrations of police departments across North America, because it seems like the only stories we hear, read about, or see about police officers are bad stories. You know, you look at Drew Peterson down in Illinois. He's still called Sergeant Drew Peterson, although he hasn't been a policeman for a long time. We don't see enough good stories about cops. There are a lot of good ones out there risking their lives every day. We only hear about the bad ones, and it may taint the public a little bit. But getting aside from that, I want to go back to Dagenais for a second and get your perspective as a journalist regarding the, I guess, the chase audio is what I'm looking at here. I've talked about it on my program before, where the Justice Albright decided not to release it to the public, although a transcript was. What are your thoughts?
Well, I found that sort of curious as well, and I guess the audio would have added another element to the public's understanding of this. At the same time, though, it's very distressing. Obviously, this was the final words spoken by these officers. I do recall, you know, my first book, Dana, that I wrote back in 2003 was called Nowhere to Run: The Killing of Constable Dennis Strongquill.
Right.
This was a Manitoba RCMP officer who was ambushed by three young people in western Manitoba, three fugitives from Alberta. And I do recall in that case, as Strongquill and his partner were being shot at on the highway, they were, of course, making desperate attempts to radio for help. We heard those that audio played at the trial of two of the accused. The third accused was actually killed by a police sniper in Saskatchewan, but the judge in that case did release the audio, even though it was obviously very distressing, no doubt, to the Strongquill family to hear Dennis's pleas for help, and knowing, of course, what ended up happening. I think the judge in that case felt that at the end of the day, it might foster a better understanding of what police went through in this situation and in general. And so in some ways, I'm disappointed that the public isn't going to get to hear that. And I don't say that as sort of a voyeur who finds anything entertaining about hearing police officers coming under attack. I just think, you know, sometimes the court process, Dana, is so sanitized that we really lose the impact of what happens there on the front lines. And I think audio like this can sometimes bring the public into the forefront and give a better appreciation of the job police have.
Well, it certainly was a tough call, no doubt about it. But carrying on a little bit, Mike, it seems like, I guess it's good for your profession and what I do here on the radio, but it seems like every time that you turn on the television or look at a paper or something, all these mass shootings across the world, United States, you can't look at a day and see good news without some nut going crazy and killing a whole bunch of people. And what's going on? Or is the world going to hell or what?
And, you know, no end in sight, Dana, just Tuesday morning. In fact, a few hours ago, we read about an incident in Alabama.
Yeah.
Four people found shot to death in a home in Alabama, and a search on for a person of interest. Of course, we had the Pittsburgh incident we just talked about. The big one over the past week was in New York in the immigration center. We had one in a nursing home down in North Carolina. You had a father who took the lives of, I believe, four or five children out in Washington State last week. And you know, I point to one major factor. I'm not saying it was the cause of all these, but I think, you know, we're all hearing the doom and gloom about the economy, especially in the United States. And unfortunately, Dana, I think we're going to see more of these.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've got a lot of people who are feeling like their world is closing in on them, you know, financially, emotionally, perhaps their relationships are being fractured. And I think that's why a lot of these cases are domestic-based, you know, fathers taking out their wives and children, mothers killing their children. And I think it is a sad state of affairs, but I do sense that the sort of bleak prognosis for our current economic environment is certainly a factor in at least some of these incidents. And, you know, in the U.S., and I don't know that I want to get into the whole debate about gun control, because I know people have very strong feelings on this, but the fact of the matter is, it is still very easy for a lot of people to get their hands on a weapon. A lot of people who should never have access to a weapon, and, you know, that's the one common link to a lot of these. They're mass shootings. They're people being shot to death, and clearly people in a very fragile emotional and mental state with easy access to weapons can often lead to very tragic results.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the gun lobbyists and the even the gun nuts, and I've had them both on the program here, have different perspectives in that. And, you know, arm everybody and this doesn't happen. I don't think so.
Yeah, you know what? And I've certainly heard that argument as well, but I just think, you know, clearly you lose some sense of control the more guns that are out there in the environment. You lose track potentially of who's got what, and you know, the results I think are what we're seeing now, and certainly the majority of gun owners very responsible. I don't blame them, but we also know, Dana, that a lot of times the people who end up with the guns, they're as a result of break-ins, irresponsible gun owners not properly storing their weapons or locking them up, protecting them, and a gun in the wrong hands obviously can be deadly.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here. The Crime and Punishment radio show on Sunday, what's coming up?
This Sunday we do continue our monthly feature that we've been doing now for a couple years with the Missing Children Society of Canada, where we feature a missing persons case. It's been very interesting. You get to hear a real cross-section of cases across Canada and the United States, some domestic, some of a random nature. This week's case is going to be a very interesting one as well. You know, I've also been writing a lot lately, and we're going to talk about this on the show, of how Canada seems to be coming a little more lately anyways, a haven for American fugitives who want to try and hide out. I just covered a story this week of a man in Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, who's been wanted for several months now for sex crimes, and somehow he was able to legally make it through the border into Canada. He's been living in Saskatchewan, and just last week, RCMP in Manitoba found him hiding out in a motel in central Manitoba. He's now in custody in Winnipeg, facing deportation back to the U.S., but like a lot of fugitives, he's going to try and claim that he ought to be allowed to stay here in Canada to protect him from the big bad U.S. justice system. I don't know that Canada ought to be portraying itself as sort of a place to run to in order to you know, be free and safe from the U.S. system, and yet that's the impression I get that a lot of criminals in the U.S. have, that if I can just get to Canada, my rights will be protected there in a way that they aren't in the U.S. So we'll get into that and other things as well.
Absolutely. They're too scared to go to Mexico. It's too dangerous for them. So
yeah, Mexico's a pretty scary place these days. for regular citizens and for criminals. And Canada, it seems, unfortunately, is often a place of refuge. And I know the cases that I've been covering are certainly stacking up. This is now about 5 or 6 examples just in the last 6 months of American fugitives caught just in Manitoba, and I suspect the same thing is going on in other provinces. And I think we got to be careful in Canada what kind of precedent we set and how much we go to bat for these accused, because I think it damages our reputation internationally.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Mike McIntyre, host of the Crime and Punishment radio show. You can see a link to Mike's website on our show notes. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are right back with tonight's Nothing But the Sacks segment. And you're actually on assignment, are you not? Robin Sacks, DA out of L.A. County.
I am. I'm on the vacation assignment. I am actually in Cabo San Lucas, hiding out in a bathroom stall so that I could actually join you, because that's how much I love this show and love what you do, Dana.
Are you sure the authorities aren't looking for you, or what's going on here?
Well, you know, it's a good thing I'm not driving right now.
All right, let's let that go. Anyway, predators and child molesters, what every parent needs to know to keep kids safe. A sex crimes DA's answers 100 of the most asked questions, and the foreword, of course, by Mark Klass is out. It's your book. Let's talk about it. What's it all about?
Well, actually, this book was prompted by a case that I handled in Los Angeles, and many people knew about. It was a big case in Los Angeles. It was the Thomas Beltran case, where a 30-year veteran teacher from Lincoln Middle School, which is a highly regarded, well-known public school in the Santa Monica area, a teacher who people loved and trusted and was actually a fantastic educator. He was an English as a second language teacher, and it came to my attention back in May of 2007, I believe, or was it 2008? Don't ask me for sure on that one. In any case, I and a 12-year-old girl had disclosed that she had been for a year been abused sexually by this man. And once the case made its way into the newspaper, we got a slew of reports. And actually, it's that case that not only inspired the book, case that should also inspire people reporting, because it really shows the power of what media can do on a positive state. You know, so often we hear about how media screws everything up and everything's so slanted and wrongly reported and creates hype and yada, yada, yada that we hear all the time. But this was a case that if the media wasn't involved, we would not have had the viral effect where podcasts and newspapers and TV shows and all sorts of stuff that were accessible online made its way all over the world and brought people to let us know that there was actually children all over the place who had been victimized by this man for over 15 years that we knew of, not to mention all the years that we didn't know of. So that case, long story short, inspired me to say, you know what, if this happened in, you know, a fancy neighborhood in the West Los Angeles area, and here amongst very educated, wonderful people who were really denying the allegations and really had no clue what to do and had no place to turn and really was failed by the school district and everyone else around them, I'm going to go and make sure that I put good information out there.
Educate.
So what I did was I created a list, and it's a list that everyone asks me every day. You know, how do you know if your kids are being sexually assaulted? What do you do about, you know, letting your kids sleep over at a divorced dad's house? Should a father be able to bathe his female daughter? All the way through, what do I do if my kid discloses? What do I do if we have to go to court? And everything from, you know, prevention through investigation, prosecution, and the most fortunate cases.
And you know, that education aspect, Robin, is so important that you do something like this is fantastic, because a lot of people, when you ask them why, they said, well, I didn't know. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to ask. I didn't know the signs, and your book, Predators and Child Molesters, the link is in our show notes. Listeners, go out there and buy it right away. It's so important, and I hope it's a huge success for you. Now, in the news this week, it's just so depressing. You can't turn on the television without sitting back and hearing about a mass shooting somewhere, about a father who's killing all his children, about policemen being killed now in Pittsburgh, I believe. It's just the world's gone to hell in a handbasket. But, you know, we're doing what we can in the media to cover these stories and try to show the people what's really going on. But really, Robin, from your perspective as a DA and someone who's in the media a lot, hosting your own show now, what are we doing right or what are we doing wrong as media when it comes to covering these tragic stories?
Well, I think there's, you know, a huge difference of what goes on in mainstream media versus what goes on kind of on the beaten path. And really, it's what's going on the beaten path that really represents what goes on every day in real courtrooms, in real police stations, in real homes throughout the country. What you do here on your show, what Scared Monkeys does, yes, you guys do report the Haleys and the Kayleys and the, you know, the Arubas and the JonBenets and all these things that many news outlets cover, and it's always nice to hear that coverage. But more importantly than that, you're covering the Becca McAvoy, the yeah. Reagan case, the other cases, and there's hundreds of them that I can list that you guys have covered, that I cover, and that other people out there who really are in the trenches every day working their butts off so that people can be aware of these cases with the number one goal of fostering change. And because of your work and because of the work that people like yourself do, it actually really does begin to put pressure on the people who are in places of authority, the chance to actually make a difference. So to that extent, I think that what people in the mainstream media haven't gotten is that they need to look beyond the sensationalism and look to the mundane. Unfortunately, the everyday is what happens every day, is the stuff that needs our attention. The balls are dropped constantly, cases fall through the cracks, and those are the things we should be focusing on.
And you're doing a great job at that yourself, ma'am. Listen, have a great vacation, and we'll see you next week.
I can't wait. Take care.
Okay, Robin. Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs with Nothing But the Sachs. You know Robin as a author, commentator, and someone who does work with the L.A. County District Attorney's Office as an ADA. All right, that's the night show. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. And for all your news and information, make sure and check out the blog at www.scaredmonkeys.com. We'll see you again next week here on The Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.